Welcome to Season 7, Episode 3 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Wednesday the 16th of April, and we're going to discuss what's been happening in the news and in the Ubuntu community. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat facility on the website and in the #UPC IRC channel on the Freenode network. I'm Mark, and joining me this week are Alan.
Hello.
Tony.
Hi.
And Laura.
Hiya.
You sound like you've got a mouthful of cake, Laura.
No, not at all.
No? Okay. Must be my imagination then.
Yeah, if you say so. It's a nice cake.
What's it called? Seminole cake?
Simnel. Easter cake. Seminole cake.
I don't know. I've never heard of this before.
Seminole cake is the Seminole Easter cake.
It seems that way. It's delicious.
Let's avoid any more jokes in that regard.
Let's get on with the show.
Okay. And now it's time for the news. And in the first piece of news is quite somber. It is the death of Windows XP.
Hey!
And there was much rejoicing.
Where's the fanfare music that I used to use?
Where is the Creative Commons licensed music? Well, it's kind of almost dead, given that the British government have paid $5.5 million to continue receiving support for another year.
Money well spent then.
Yes. It's not like they had any warning that this was going to happen at all.
I remember when it was born.
Using it for the first time on like one of my mate's PCs in his bedroom.
Be about 12 years old now.
What, Mark?
For
his friend. No. I actually, it came out the week we moved into our house.
Oh, wow.
And I remember having a pirated copy on a desktop PC.
We don't endorse that.
No.
Or condone it,
even. I'm just saying. And I remember my dad being quite impressed by it, I think. And actually, I remember getting up the next day after that party and getting really angry because someone had spilt beer all over my keyboard. And I sent an email around to all my friends and was like, which one of you spilt beer all over my keyboard? And they were like, Alan, mate, it was you.
That's a good thing about those keyboards is you could just put them in the dishwasher and bring them out again and dry them out. The old clackety-clack ones. Buckling spring technology.
So what are people going to upgrade to then if XP is...
Well, you can't buy Windows 7 anymore, can you?
No.
So presumably the upgrade path is Windows 8.
Yeah.
Yeah, but a machine that's running XP is potentially going to be something of the order of 10 years old, maybe slightly less.
Yep.
It's not going to run Windows 7 either.
No. Some people might throw as much RAM at it as they can, or they'll just throw it away and decide that's the point at which time they move on to something else, which will be a new laptop or might be a tablet or some people optimistically hope Linux.
Mm. Yeah. Do you think Linux is going to get a big boost out of the death of XP?
No.
Oh, don't be so pessimistic. No. Why not?
I was being really
Ubuntu's
thoughtful,
not going to run on it, is it? If it's not, if it won't run Windows 7.
And Ubuntu Flavor would run on
there are some lightweight distros that would run on a Windows XP era
Zubuntu
machine.
Exactly.
Things like CrunchBang or Lubuntu or Subuntu or something like that.
Or just a shell.
But I don't. But I think it's more than that, though, because people migrating off XP are not just. It's not just the OS. They've got, years and years, possibly 10 or more years invested in that computer. So there might be lots of photos and videos and all their documents and stuff. So it's not just a case of throwing it away and getting something else. Yeah, they've got to work out this migration. And I think a lot of people will just stay with it.
Yeah, until their hard disk dies. Yeah. And then they say, oh, no, I've lost everything anyway. I might as well buy a new computer.
Yeah.
I reckon it'll be less households and more people like doctors and dentists.
Well, the thing that I wonder about the whole British government getting support thing is Windows XP is the last version to still have support for IE6. We know that there's been, lots of apps like intranet type systems which have been built for IE6 with lots of ActiveX stuff, which took a long time to get migrated off, if ever. So I'm wondering if some of the reason that they need support for it is because they're still running stuff on IE6, which is terrifying.
Yeah, maybe.
It could just be the hardware thing, of course. They've got lots of old hardware kicking around on desktops and stuff that hasn't been replaced, can't afford to be replaced at such short notice of three or four years.
And I don't think households keep them that long. I think they replace them when they break, even if it's just software, they'll replace the hardware as well.
I think it depends. I mean, you know, young families often, you know, the kids all have newer mobile devices. But yeah, I know a fair few people who've got a PC in a bedroom somewhere, and it's, you know, it gets turned on every so often, and it's got XP on it and it runs okay.
Mm. Fair enough. Well, good luck to everybody who's trying to shuffle their way off the mortal coil of XP. Mm. You might have heard in the news there's been a slight security issue.
What?
Regarding the OpenSSL software being dubbed Heartbleed. But it's a sort of, you know, fairly nasty bug that risks exposing everything over...
What exactly is the problem then?
What exactly is the problem? The problem...
Come on, Tony.
Your electrifying personality there, Alan. Basically, it's a non-string length thing. Basically, the client can ask...
Tell me more.
Very well explained.
XKCD,
you know, we do those
job.
Things where I try to explain stuff and I don't really understand it, and I try to make out I do.
No.
This isn't one of those.
Okay.
For comedy
is it
purposes.
Is it definitely not?
Because no. You used to work as a sysadmin, didn't you? So you know this sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm not a developer, though. But basically...
Would you like me to explain it, Tony?
The client, no.
Mark's going to come to the rescue now.
The client can ask for more characters back than it should do, and therefore the server will send those characters back, even if they are not the characters they're supposed to be, and it might include sensitive personal information or security information.
That's basically the XKCD explanation, isn't it?
But with fewer drawings.
Yes.
Yeah. Mark, I mean, have you got anything you want to add to that?
No,
yeah, well, that's pretty comprehensive, really.
Yeah.
That's a Bruce Schneier kind of level
there,
of
there was a feature added to OpenSSL called Heartbeat, where basically you could say to the server, like, basically, tell me that you're still there by saying, here's a message and it's this long, and send it back. And then if you said, here's a message and it's this long, but that wasn't the length it actually was, then it would still, as you say, send some characters. But those characters would be essentially whatever OpenSSL last had in memory, which is likely to be something which was encrypted, like, you know, sensitive data, personal documents,
passwords, right.
Or really boring
encryption
stuff.
Keys, that sort of thing. Or really boring stuff, yeah. But potentially not really boring stuff to someone malicious.
And this was introduced in quite a relatively recent version of OpenSSL.
2 years ago.
Two years ago, but which by server standards is, you know, for instance, if you're running a stable CentOS or Debian or Red Hat server, then it won't have it because they wouldn't have updated to that version of OpenSSL. But if you're running an Ubuntu server or something which tends to have more recent packages, then you will have it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the moral of the story is, don't run Ubuntu server. It's massively insecure.
Okay. Or run a really old one.
Yeah. I mean, my Debian VPS, my Bitfolk VPS, wasn't vulnerable.
If you're still running 10.04, yeah, you're probably fine.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Anyway, so it's a massive thing. Lots of sites have been vulnerable to attack using this route. So lots of people are recommending changing passwords and things. It's only worth doing that once the sites concerned have been patched. Otherwise, you can just get compromised again. Sites like Mumsnet were believed to have been compromised to a degree with the Heartbleed.
Yeah, I'm not sure how they think they were compromised.
Well, this is the thing, because these people have come out saying, "Oh, we think we've been compromised," but part of the reason this bug is so nasty is it doesn't leave any trace.
Yes, so you don't know that your details have or haven't got split.
Right,
spilt. Alan's buzzing a little bit. We might have to have a look at this. Okay, so, yeah, basically, you know, check your stuff, check your sites, check your security updates, or run old versions of software.
Like XP.
Like Windows like XP. Was XP vulnerable to it or not?
I dread to think.
Okay. Laura, what's up next on the news?
Yes. So the Open Rights Group has launched an Indiegogo campaign to raise money for a campaign video against internet censorship in the UK. If you go for the top perk, you get your name mentioned in the video. Yay! And I think that's already gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not really sure why they did it as an Indiegogo campaign, because it doesn't... I mean, looking at the rewards for contributing to it, none of them make me think, oh, yeah, really, really good thing to contribute towards.
Yeah.
So why didn't they just do it as an Open Rights Group campaign on their website?
Also, I was reading the thing, the blurb about it, and it seemed as if they'd already made the video, but they needed the money for the campaign, and what would have been useful is an explanation of what campaign costs are. Because most people don't know, unless they work for a charity or something, I'd have thought.
Yeah, it does seem like a bit of an odd way of going about it. And yeah, like as I say, the top perk is, you know, having your name mentioned in the video for £750.
Which somebody's paid.
Which someone's paid, so they obviously thought it was worth it. But
really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can put a video up on YouTube with your name in it for
I know. Or, you know, you get to the £10, which is the basic level, is you get to see the video one day before it's publicly released.
Well, there's a sound investment.
Yeah, but anyway, I mean, it's
halfway there.
As much as I'm talking this down, it is a really worthwhile campaign. I think I just don't think it's a very good choice for Indiegogo. But yeah, it's basically about highlighting the issues around internet censorship and compulsory filtering, which the government are trying to mandate that ISPs bring in, and right. trying to guilt parents into doing it because otherwise their children won't be safe or something.
Yeah, yes. And it's a humorous video trying to make the points to parents, I think.
I got the same feeling from the pitch that Jim was giving. It felt like they'd done it already.
Yeah.
And this was just marketing.
Ooh. We thought we fixed Alan, but he's broken again. I don't know.
I think it's the cat having eaten my microphone. That's what it is.
It could be.
Not the podcat.
You know what? After 7 years of doing this podcast, we finally found a way of shutting him up.
But anyway, so who's next?
I'm next, Mark is in next. Fact. An independent audit of the TrueCrypt disk encryption system has concluded, and it has found that there is no evidence of intentional flaws in the technology or backdoors put in by people like the NSA and GCHQ.
But a few possible mistakes, but that was all fine.
Yeah, so there's some things, like the quality of the code in some places isn't as good as it could be, and there's odd bugs here and there, which
which
could possibly compromise it a bit until they're fixed, but it doesn't look like they've been put in there on purpose by someone.
And that's what they said about OpenSSL.
who did the audit?
It was an independent security company who also audited some other things, which I didn't write down, but like fairly high profile, some Microsoft products and some other stuff.
They also don't know who they're working for. Because the TrueCrypt developers are anonymous.
Oh, yes.
Or like to keep themselves anonymous.
What, anonymous with a capital A?
No. Anonymous with a little A.
Although there could well be an overlap between the two.
Yeah.
We don't know.
We just don't know because they're anonymous.
Yes. But yeah, TrueCrypt is a clever encryption system because it lets you do a plausibly deniable encryption system where you can have an encrypted volume within what looks like blank space, because the blank space is also encrypted.
So you could go to, let's say you go through customs and the TSA or the British police under the law can ask you for your passwords.
Yeah.
Oh, right, yeah.
And you give them your passwords, knowing that there is an encrypted volume on there.
Yeah.
And you give them the password to the encrypted volume. There could well be further encrypted data inside that you don't tell them about. They can't find it because... It looks exactly the same as blank space.
So they have no way of proving that if you entered a different encryption key, then actually it decrypts all the stuff which you didn't want them to see.
Yeah. So give them one key that lets them see all the kitten pictures and a completely separate key that has all your passwords and other stuff in it.
I think they'll catch on pretty quickly if lots of suspicious people start producing drives of kitten pictures.
But they can't prove otherwise. Allegedly.
That's the beauty of kittens.
Yes. moving on, Boy Genius Report have got a post about the Samsung Galaxy S5S fingerprint scanner having been hacked.
Right. So is this where you use a sausage to break in?
No, they... no. It's, you know how... I think there's various technologies of fingerprint scanner. Some of them you just hold your finger over, and some of them you have to swipe your finger. And some technologies are more susceptible.
Gently.
Exactly, more susceptible.
They're basically all taking a picture of your finger and trying to decide whether it's actually a finger or not.
Right, and they've discovered that actually it's not as secure on this particular model of phone as it is on other phones.
Is it a software problem or a hardware problem?
I don't think they found that the way that it's implemented is. Makes it somewhat less secure than other phones, but the actual scanner, you can fool it in the same way as you can with other scanners. So it's not the fingerprint recognition stuff that's less secure. It's just the fact that things like once you reboot the phone, you can unlock it without entering a password, just using the fake thumb or whatever.
Right.
Which with an iPhone, you have to, when you boot it, you have to enter a password the first time, and then you can just use your thumb.
Oh, I see.
Right.
Yes. Mm. But then, didn't Mythbusters do this in like 2006?
Yeah, with a sausage or with sellotape.
Something.
I've seen
sellotape and a sausage.
I would have hoped the technology would move on from something debunked by Mythbusters in the past.
But apparently it hasn't.
Or something that's been debunked by, like, James Bond. And...
The Mythbusters episode is all this stuff in films about how you can do it by, you know, copying a thumbprint actually true, and it is true. So...
But you have to remember that it's a bit of an arms race, and sausage technology has also moved on quite a lot in the last few years.
Moving on.
The Guardian and Washington Post newspapers have been awarded the Pulitzer Prize for public service for their reporting of the NSA revelations. This is the Edward Snowden hacking allegations.
Yeah, there was a tense moment this week when Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, I think is her filmmaker, is the filmmaker, that they were flying from... Germany to America to go to an awards ceremony. I don't think it was said that it was this awards ceremony, it was another one. It seemed everyone had their eyes on various flight tracking websites to see when the flight would land in New York, because they didn't know if Glenn Greenwald and Laura would be picked up by the TSA or picked up by the American Secret Service for revealing what they
sort of crimes against the state.
It seems they weren't accosted at the airport and they were allowed to pass through and then, you know, receive this rather amazing reward.
Fair enough. Excellent. Well, that looks like all the news that we have time for right now, so we will do something else instead.
It's time for some community news.
Huzzah!
So the Gnome Foundation's facing a budget shortfall as payments to the Gnome Outreach Program for Women aren't being met. As payments aren't being met with regular payments from donors and sponsors. So basically, the money that they were supposed to get or were hoping to get hasn't come in time, and they've been oversubscribed, or it's been really popular program.
Cash flow.
Yes,
basically. Right. So if you've ever thought about like giving them some money in the past but never got around to it, they said now would be a good time.
It'd be really helpful.
Really.
So there was a big brouhaha on interwebs where people were complaining, oh, well, this just shows that they shouldn't be spending money
on women.
You know, women. Those women bleeding the Gnome Foundation dry.
Yeah, it wouldn't be in this place without women.
Yeah, which is clearly not the case. It's partly a cash flow issue and partly the fact that it was a successful campaign.
Yeah.
They do seem to have had a bit of a whip round from people in order to try and solve some of this problem.
Right.
And they think they're all right for the next 2 or 3 months now. But, you know, nobody send them any nasty invoices.
Yeah, and they said they're just cutting all the costs for the rest of the year to try
no
and get
more
back
women.
On.
We've got enough women.
Enough
is
women.
That what you're saying?
Yeah,
we've got
basically.
All the women we can afford.
Yeah.
That's Mark.
And cats.
That was, yes.
And cats.
Yeah.
Right.
No more cat sponsorship.
It's interesting, I guess, the Gnome Foundation is mostly run by volunteers and you know, these... finances are probably not the most closely looked at things in the world.
That was the problem.
Well, exactly, yeah.
Okay, that's unfortunate.
They just there was something that was complex or just wasn't kept an eye on, and it all just took them ages then to work it out, and then they got the bad news.
Excellent.
Ubuntu 14.04 LTS is released tomorrow, or
yay,
today if you're listening to the download
or
on the day
week.
Of release, or, you know, yeah.
Last
it's
week,
already happened
if
you're listening to it any later than that.
Yeah.
And we'll talk more about that on the next show, I think.
Which will be after it's been released.
Yes. Well, unless you're listening live, in which case it'll be
before.
In about half an hour.
Wow, we should get rid of these caveats. It's really not working.
That's 8:30 if you're in the UK.
Yeah, we'll talk about that next time.
Yeah.
Marcus Costales has published an interview with the IT manager of a Spanish school about migrating the school's computers from Windows XP to Ubuntu 14.04.
Topical?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good interview. Like, he's talking through all the sort of... you know, the various reasons for it, what they're upgrading from. So there's mostly Windows XP, and then a few of the, like, the teachers and the senior management had newer computers, so they've got Windows 7 or Windows 8. And then he's talking a bit about the software they're running and how most of it is just, you know, they'll move from Photoshop to the GIMP, and they'll move from Microsoft Office to LibreOffice. But then the textbooks all have their digital resources in as Windows programs. So he's been contacting them and saying, look, you either need to make it so these that we can use these on Linux, or we're going to have to find another textbook provider.
It's cheaper to do that, presumably, than licensing keep on Photoshop or Office.
So it was about 100 computers, and the migration took 2 months. And one of the questions he asked was, how much is it going to cost you? And he said, well, we're not paying for official support, although that might be a good option. The real cost is zero, as we're doing it ourselves.
Wow.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's rather cool.
Yeah.
I think it's an argument whether you can say the real cost of that is
zero. Well, you know, it depends how valuable your time is, yes, and what you're not doing while you're doing that. But, yeah.
And if what you're not doing is not administering Windows XP, that's fine.
And also not upgrade. Well,
and not upgrading.
Yeah, the other thing you'd be doing is upgrading from Windows XP to Windows 7 and paying, oh, sorry, to Windows 8 and paying the licensing costs for that. So he's got to upgrade to something, so his time will be spent upgrading. It's whether he's upgrading to something which costs money or something which doesn't.
True, good point, good point. Okay, so updated Ubuntu cloud images have been released on various cloud providers in response to the OpenSSL Heartbleed bug. You'll remember the incisive commentary we gave on that earlier in the news the news segment. But basically, so the images that you get by default if you're deploying virtual machines into the Ubuntu cloud are now fully patched, up to date, and secure against this particular vulnerability.
Well, that's good news.
Yes. Isn't it? Isn't it wonderful where you can just do these things, respin it, and, you know, off you go again.
Mm.
Don't leak your data all over the internet. Isn't it wonderful?
Yes, Tony.
Oh, my Debian VPS. Did I mention that wasn't vulnerable?
Your Debian VPS was old and crusty and wasn't vulnerable. Is that what you said?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yes, you did mention that.
Good. Just want to make sure that I got that right. Laura, what's up next?
Colin Watson has blogged about the pain of porting GHC, the Glasgow Haskell compiler, to new architectures.
Sounds exciting.
Well, you know, it's one of those things that someone has to do, and I found it really interesting to read. It's not like super deeply technical. Mm. It's more about, you know, how he... you know, the interaction with various people to get the work done, and how he had to keep coming back to it over a period of time because there were some things that were, you know, felt insurmountable at the time and were frustrating him, so he had to go away and go. It's like the story of over a few months.
So this isn't doubting it, but what's the point of it, and what's it for?
Haskell or
no,
the GHC, new architecture.
Well, any of it.
So your laptop is x86,
yes,
right? And so often developers will target x86. They'll build on their local machine and it will work, right? Mm-hmm. And then along comes someone who makes a laptop that doesn't have an Intel chip in it, like Chromium, mm-hmm. Google with the Chrome OS running.
You've been branded.
Thingies. Yeah, those things. And you might want to run the software from that developer on this laptop, which is a different architecture. And it might well be that because the developer has never tried running it on an ARM-based machine, it's never been ported, it's never been compiled. And then when someone tries to compile it, it actually doesn't even compile. So you can't even use it because it doesn't compile. Now, what Colin's blog post is about is the fact that we're bringing Ubuntu 14.04 to the IBM Power architecture.
Yay!
And yes, yay! but a lot of apps in the archive have never been ported to PowerPC. They've never been run on it.
Right.
And as a result, they don't compile for whatever reason. Some of them are, you know, wacky, bizarre, esoteric errors, and some of them are assumptions made by the original developers based on the architecture that they're currently sat on, or configuration options they've set wrong, or memory space, or some, you know. Anyway, Colin had this task to do, and it's quite an interesting read about how he went about it.
Yeah,
given that I think he said he's never written any Haskell code. He doesn't really know Haskell at all. but he's porting the compiler from one platform to another. It's quite cool.
All those Haskell users will be very pleased and thankful for Colin's work.
Well, do you remember we interviewed a couple of guys who'd written a game called Nicky and the Robots?
Yes.
Yes.
That was written in Haskell.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Ah, well, it's useful for something then. I thought that was written in Vol for
you
some
could,
reason.
You could get your IBM Power architecture server and build Nicky and the Robots to run on it.
Brilliant.
Maybe not.
Mm.
And finally, in this week's community news, Robert Ansell has kicked off a discussion on the Ubuntu desktop mailing list about convergence plans for 14.10 and beyond.
Yes. Convergence, that sounds buzzwordy.
Yeah.
is that that thing with where you get a Windows app and it runs on your PC as well as your Windows phone?
Yeah, it could be. So with 1404 almost out the door as we speak,
yes,
I think he wanted to, you know, start the discussion about how we, some of the tasks that we need to look at between now and 1410 and so and beyond.
The plan for 1410 is going to be no more X and no more Unity 7 and Convergence.
Well, not really. I think the target is 1604 will
right.
be the fully converged,
right.
all
LTS.
Of that done. Which steps we do in between, in the 2 years between now and 1604, mm-hmm. you know, that's the bit we've got to plan out and figure right. out if, you know, if it makes sense for us to go crazy and switch now, or whether we need to, you know, get device drivers done or apps ported or other infrastructure stuff, or, you know, wait until we've moved across to system D, or, you know, all these kind of other things. We've got to kind of time them all right so they don't all land at the same time and end up with a completely broken release, mm-hmm. you know, the one just after an LTS that commonly gets a reputation
<NDF'd>.
for being the being the cowboy broken. Release. You know, possibly unwarranted, but, you know, it has that reputation. We need to plan those things out. And he brought up a number of things that we need to think about. And a couple of them that obviously I'm slightly interested in because they
what
come from
be?
A mobile. Well, he's talked a bit about the Ubuntu system settings, which is the settings app that we have on the phone,
mm-hmm.
and bringing that so it works on the desktop, because there are things you have that you configure on the desktop that you don't have on a phone. So we need to make those things configurable, like multi-screen stuff. That we don't have on the phone. We don't
but
have
you
settings
will want
for that.
Because,
but we will
yes,
want, yes.
Right.
And things like core apps as well. So things
yeah,
like calculator.
That was the other thing, talking about the core apps, because we're moving towards a QML-based shell, Unity 8, whether it arrives in as default in 1410 or beyond.
Yeah.
We need to target a set of apps that we can deliver with a default install. And whether the apps that we have on the phone are going to be those apps, or whether we need to bring up a bunch of other apps, or bring in apps from outside, port things, or write things from scratch. You know, those are conversations we need to have between now and 1604, which is that target for full convergence.
So can, when the Unity 8 shell is running QML, can you not still run non-QML apps, or have QML apps by default, non-QML apps by default, rather?
Well, it's kind of the same issue that you have now, where, you know, if you run GTK apps under KDE or KDE apps under GTK,
yeah,
you know, they kind of look out of place. They don't have the same theme. They don't have the same widget set.
Right.
Know.
Okay.
So I think the target is that by 1604 we have fully converged apps.
Can't you just use all the KDE apps from Kubuntu?
We may well, we could well bring in, you know, some of the KDE apps. I'm not sure we'd want all of them, but yeah, certainly some of them could be brought over. But yeah, it's an interesting start to the discussion, and you know, it's fun that at this time in the cycle, just as we're releasing, you think there's going to be some rest because you just put the release out, but it's now right full
That's
steam ahead
for
the next
you.
One. Yeah, it's, yeah, that one's done. Right, moving on.
There is no rest. There is no respite.
The Ubuntu podcast needs you. Yes, you. If you hear something that entertains, engages, or enrages you, tweet at UUPC or email podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. You can also talk to us on the telephone, Skype, Facebook, and Google+. Find links to all these places on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. Please do get in touch. I mean it. Just one message. Just to know there's someone out there who cares.
And that's all for not episode one, as it says on my piece of paper, but in fact episode 3 of the 7th season of the Ubuntu podcast.
Very well done.
We'll be back next week with our thoughts on Ubuntu 14.04.
Yes.
And some more quality chat.
Command line love, I think.
Oh, command line love, even better.
So many things.
More cake.
More cake? I think you've had enough.
Right.
Really? Yeah.
Tea might might go
tea
down
would
well.
Be good.
Let's get the kettle on. Bye-bye.